From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today is Monday, August 9th.
Ransomware has become much more prolific and profitable for ransomware actors, primarily because of cryptocurrency.
That was Jamie Tarabay, cybersecurity reporter with Bloomberg, talking about the recent surge in cyber attacks both here in the U.S. and globally. We're going to dig into that a little bit later, but first, your morning headlines. We begin with COVID. Currently, the highest case count per capita in the world is Louisiana, with 99 cases per 100,000. That's followed by Botswana and then Florida. Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy publicly distanced himself from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis on Sunday, saying he disagrees with the governor's decision to ban local mask mandates amidst a deadly surge of COVID cases that has state hospitals and ICUs nearing capacity. DeSantis recently pressured health and education departments in the state to bar school mask mandates. With schools starting to reopen for the fall and case counts reaching a level not seen since January, the battle over masking in schools is taking place across the country. Some states, like California and Illinois, have mandates in place, while others, like Florida and Georgia, have banned them. According to the CDC, children now account for up to 20% of all new COVID cases across the country. Florida reported on Sunday the highest number of children hospitalized with COVID to date, 172. The Senate cleared procedural hurdles on the passage of a $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure plan late Sunday night. It's one of President Joe Biden's top priorities. The Senate had debated the bill over the weekend, negotiating amendments and the timing to consider them. They ended debate with a 68-29 vote on Sunday, setting the bill up for final passage as early as Monday. It will then head to the House, which is expected to take up the bill when it returns from recess in September. Turning now to California, where historically low moisture levels turned the Dixie Fire into the second largest wildfire in its history. The wildfire currently has burned over 450,000 acres and is only 21% contained. The cause of the fire remains under investigation and is not expected to be fully contained for weeks. California Fire spokesman Edwin Zuniga told the Washington Post that they're seeing fire activity that even veteran firefighters haven't seen in their career. He went on to call the situation uncharted territory. And now to our daily deep dive. Cybercrime has been skyrocketing across the U.S. as bad state actors and criminals alike turn to invasive technologies to accomplish either political goals or economic ones. What's fueling this spike? And more importantly, what can we do about it? Today, we're talking to Jamie Tarabay, cybersecurity journalist with Bloomberg. Hey, Jamie, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You bet. So I want to get to some of this breaking news, this developing story that the Department of Homeland Security announced last week. It's going to partner with Amazon, Google, Microsoft, and others to create what's known as a joint cyber defense collaborative. They're going to try and fight cyber threats specifically related to critical infrastructure. What prompted this move? And how do you think this will work with the government and the private sector?
It's kind of interesting to those of us who have been covering cyber for a little while, at least, just to see the rise in prominence that cybersecurity has had, particularly over the last 6 to 18 months, particularly once everyone started working from home. And I think that was really the catalyst for it. People really kind of came under attack in their own homes. And most people are still working from home. So there are still so many security vulnerabilities out there. I think last year was really a year of cyber education for not just the US, but for the world, because a lot of what transpired since then has been just learning basic things, but also learning how to fortify your system. So I think one of the things that really prompted the move is, like I said, it's really risen to prominence in a way that we haven't seen before. Normally, when you have a cybersecurity conversation, it's not really at the level of sort of presidents, but in Geneva in June, it was one of the topics that Vladimir Putin and Joe Biden talked about, because we had just come from the Colonial Pipeline attack, which really pressured the fuel supply along the eastern seaboard. We had the JBS hack. This is real world consequences. And what you're seeing now is this attempt between the public sector and the private sector to connect, to do a lot more monitoring, particularly when it comes to cloud protection services, to really sort of be much more proactive in mitigating threats. And one of the challenges that we see is when something does happen in the private sector, having companies actually admit it, right? No one wants to ever talk about the fact that they've been hacked.
So tell me, who are these attackers? Are they just individuals that see an opportunity? Are they more nefarious players like government-sponsored groups who are involved in the cybercrime game? Who are they?
Well, the short answer is all of them. And I think we need to sort of take it into context. We saw so many what we call targets of opportunity. Suddenly, all of these people whose security systems were left in the workplace and they suddenly were all working from home, all of their data was suddenly vulnerable and ripe for attack. So those were really targeted by your regular cyber criminals who want to make a quick buck. You also had nation state attackers. So Chinese state-sponsored groups, Russian state-sponsored groups, North Korean state-sponsored groups, hacking pharmaceuticals, looking for vaccine research. And then you also had nation state-sponsored groups that do their normal espionage, intellectual property, using the cover of COVID to try and infiltrate people in that way as well. The ones who have been making the biggest noise and been getting most of our attention at the moment are the ransomware groups, particularly the ones who are behind the JBS hack and the Colonial Pipeline hack. Those are believed to be, because we don't have anything conclusive, they're believed to be Russian associated. What we know about these groups is that within their platforms, they search for targets, but they isolate and exclude targets that are in the Cyrillic language. So anything that's Slavic or Russian, they stay well away from. They offer what we know now as a ransomware as a service, which is essentially like a subscription-based model where you can say, I have these administrative privileges. I can get into this company. Can you let me have your software so I can go in there? And we can lock it up and exfiltrate and then start extorting these people.
You know, the NSA recently issued a joint cybersecurity advisory saying that the Russian military intelligence groups were using what they're calling brute force to attack really critical infrastructure here in the US as well as abroad. What does that mean? What is a brute force attack and what's at stake?
What that means is that whoever launched the attacks against them was able to corral the networks of thousands of computers or internet connected devices to target their website. So it's usually something that's public facing and impacts them in a way where they can't operate. It seizes up all of their traffic. So their internet is slow, their systems are slow, and they basically say that we will not restart this until you pay us $200,000 in Bitcoin or $200,000 or something like that. And that's basically what happened to the New Zealand Stock Exchange last year was a very good example of that. But it was a campaign that crossed the entire planet. It went to Southeast Asia, it went to Europe, and it also went to South America. So brute force is literally throwing everything in the kitchen sink at your internet and seeing if you can survive the attack. So it's a tool that nation states can use in diplomacy or, you know, the geopolitical game, basically.
The Washington Post found that ransomware attacks in the U.S. more than doubled from 2019 to 2020, taking in an estimated $400 million last year by just simply holding companies' data ransom until it pays. Why are these kinds of attacks increasing? And what's at stake for the average U.S. consumer?
Let me try to answer the second part of that question first. And I think what we've always found is whenever companies have to start paying more for their expenses, that cost always gets passed on to the consumer. So whether that translates into higher fuel prices or, you know, our steak suddenly costs more, ransomware has become much more prolific and profitable for ransomware actors, primarily because of cryptocurrency. It's so much easier now for them to move cash virtually, anonymously, without being traced. The other reason is because a lot of companies now have cyber insurance, and those companies would sooner pay the ransom if they know that they're covered under their insurance rather than lose operating costs and delays in trying to figure out how they can go through their systems and work backwards and try to reconfigure their own data backups and things like that. If it wasn't a cost of business before, I really want to believe that it is now, because you will pay at some point. You either pay in the beginning when you beef up your security, or you pay at the end where you have to pay a ransom. So it's a reality that it's a very easy way for people to make money now. It's an easier way for them to get paid and take it out without anyone sort of finding them.
You mentioned beefing up. I want to talk about beef. You know, back in June, meat producer JBS, it supplies about a fifth of all the beef in the U.S. It paid something like $11 million in ransom money to get back access to its computers. These are real companies that impact everyday citizens across the globe. What are some of the other industries being hit hard by cyber? What can they do about it?
When the meatpacking plants went quiet, people lost their shifts. People couldn't go to work. So the ripple effect is not just, oh my goodness, there's going to be a run on steaks. It's, I'm not going to be able to make rent this week. So it's not just one particular industry anymore. It's literally everything. It could be a telco. It could be a bank. It could be just basically anything that relies on systems to make the trains run on time. And because so much of our lives are online now and so much of our lives are digital, it's not something that's going to go away anytime soon.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with Jamie Tarabay, cybersecurity journalist with Bloomberg. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. We're here with Jamie Tarabay, cybersecurity journalist with Bloomberg. You've compared this to drug dealers. I want to quote something from a recent article you wrote back in June. You say, ransomware for the last few months was kind of like drug dealers who were openly standing on the corner selling drugs. What do you mean by that?
They were very obvious about what they were doing. If you knew where to find them, they were on the dark web. They advertise what they do. They go into agreements with affiliates to band together to take on targets that for a long time they had said, like, we're not going to hit orphanages or hospitals or anything that's like socially critical or anything like that. I mean, we've seen that that's no longer the case. What I meant in that article was that before, like drug dealers, they were quite loud and open and defiant of authority. And once there was too much heat on that street corner, they went and moved and found a different street corner. We've seen them get quiet. So, you know, they come and they go. And just like your criminals, basically, you know, they sort of test the water, see whether it's worth popping their heads up or not. But the test really is going to be how much influence people like Vladimir Putin have over these ransomware hackers who operate out of Russia, whether they're incentivized to shut them down. We know from some of the forums that they are watching to see if people get arrested. We know that they're talking amongst themselves, but also outside the circles. And our intelligence security circles are watching to see whether there's going to be an impact. They're also wondering whether they're going to get a tap on the shoulder.
Beyond going to Vladimir Putin and addressing this directly, is there anything else the U.S. government can be doing to protect corporations and individuals?
They do takedowns of these groups as well. They don't do it very loudly because they don't want to say exactly who it is, because they don't want them to know that they've figured it out. And that would be betraying their tradecraft as well. Because, you know, I mean, Putin will say, well, give us proof. And they don't want to give him proof, because then they'll have to say, well, this is how we figured it out. And so they'll know, okay, well, next time, let's not do that. But again, it really comes back to the exchange of information, disclosure, transparency. We're seeing more and more pressure on private companies to disclose when they have been attacked. There's a lot of conversations happening about paying ransom payments. In some countries around the world, the governments do not want them to do that. But if they don't, then they have to provide recourse for companies who don't feel like they have any choice. And then sometimes you have companies that basically before they thought they had pretty good basic cybersecurity protection, now finding they have to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars. And for a lot of people, that's a cost of business that they can't afford. Some people, however, who do pay end up getting ransomware again because they've shown that they can pay. So it's a really complicated thing. And what I like about it now is that we're having this conversation and that it is being discussed, because this is something that a lot of people just weren't aware of or weren't invested in before. And now it's at the level of presidents and countries. So now it actually is sort of a little more significant in terms of priorities.
Jamie, for the regular person listening to this podcast, are there things that we could do at home to prevent ourselves from being hacked or attacked? Should we all be using VPNs?
One of the first things that everyone can do is make sure they've changed the password on their router at home. Okay, a lot of people don't. A lot of people have 1, 2, 3, 4. You can actually go onto certain websites and pull up cameras. And I was watching one of my security analyst sources just show me a feed of all of these cameras that are open to the public, and many of them were in people's homes, and it was terrifying. So, you know, it's you lock your front door. So there's loads of doors that you leave open at home, whether you have security cameras, you have webcams, you have computer networks, you have, your Alexa password. I mean, it's just the ways that you can do that is literally go through every single thing in your house and think, okay, does this have a password? Have I changed it lately? And then there's little things that you can do. So never, ever, ever, ever use free public Wi-Fi. Please don't ever do that. Never, ever, ever stick your phone charger into one of those charging stations that you see. You know, it's just because there are people waiting for you to do that, and they can lock onto the network and they can try to infiltrate your phone. So protect your phone like you protect your wallet, like, you protect your house. And you have to have that mindset, because every way that you think you might be okay, there are a million people out there thinking all the time of how they can get past all of those defenses.
But what if you're in a hotel on a plane and you have no other option?
VPN. Yeah. You know, I mean, and that's not, don't get the free one. Okay. Do not get free VPN. I have to say, it's not that expensive, and people will pay so much for so many other things that you can question. If you're going to buy an app on your phone for a game, you can buy an app on your phone for a VPN.
Some simple things that can really transform your security at home. Jamie Tarabay, cybersecurity journalist with Bloomberg. Thank you for joining us, Jamie.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been really fun.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. The trial of R&B singer R. Kelly begins in Brooklyn. He's charged with racketeering based on sexual exploitation of children, kidnapping, and forced labor. The 54-year-old performer has been accused of sexually exploiting his victims over a 20-year period, with most complaints being settled in civil court. Kelly has been in custody since 2019 and has pleaded not guilty to all charges. R. Kelly faces a possible second trial in Illinois on charges of pornography and obstruction. Today marks the 47th anniversary of President Richard Nixon's resignation as President of the United States. Nixon resigned after members of his administration were caught breaking into and legally wiretapping the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate Hotel. Nixon spoke on his resignation the night before he left.
I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first.
The Twitter tributes have been pouring in for Barry, the barred owl. The Central Park celebrity passed away early Friday morning. Messages like this one have been flooding social media. You brought us much joy and inspiration at such a dark time, and we will miss you dearly. Barry had delighted local fans and birding enthusiasts from around the world since her arrival in New York City last October. She was known for her frequent appearances during the day and also by how photogenic she was. According to the Central Park Conservancy, Barry died after making contact with a maintenance vehicle, likely while searching for food. Barry was estimated to be just a little over 1 year old. A vigil commemorating what would have been Barry's 10-month anniversary of living in Central Park will be held tonight underneath the hemlock tree she used to call home. Have a great Monday, everyone. I'll see you back tomorrow morning. This is a Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from The Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Jeremy Tarabay for being on the show. And if you like this episode, I hope you'll subscribe to The Recount Daily Pod and leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.